Welcome to this five-part grazing podcast series brought to you by the BC Forage Council and the Peace River Forage Association. This chat is with Joseph Molliott from Avalee Sheep Farm. Joseph runs a sheep and beef operation about 2 hours north of Kamloops in the Upper North Thompson. He shares how wolf predation originally pushed him into more intensive rotational grazing, lessons learned on where to actually place your fence, and electric fencing tips for sheep. For context, this chat was recorded in midsummer of 2023. Funding for this project has in part been provided by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada through the Agriculture Climate Solutions Living Labs program. Well, Joseph, thanks so much for making the time to talk to me today. I would love to hear a bit about your farming operation and how you're set up.
For sure. So I'll give you kind of a current snapshot of kind of where we're at right now. So our primary enterprise is sheep, dual-purpose breed, primarily the Corriedale. So they have wool quality as well as meat finishability. And so that's the breed we've stuck with for about 100 years now. My great-grandfather started getting into that. And just recently, we've gotten into cattle. So we just have a small cow-calf operation. So we're looking at about 12 cow-calf pairs. And the primary intention with that enterprise is for raising grass-finished beef and kind of alongside with our sheep operation. The numbers of sheep, we're looking at about 650 pairs right now. Of course, with sheep, at least half of them usually are twins. So, higher percentage with sheep than with cattle. Our primary marketing for marketing the sheep is actually through live lamb sales. We usually just sell to a buyer in Alberta, where they usually keep them as breeding stock or finishers or feeders, because that's just kind of where the general market is going. However, we're pushing more and more currently, trying to do a little bit more every year, hitting the grass-finished market, the value-added market, selling directly to the customers. So we're currently selling about 100 lambs every year. And like I said, slowly trying to build that up. Direct to restaurants and just a lot of families and individuals throughout the province. And we kind of see that as the most sustainable way forward. We can kind of dictate or command the prices that we require for production. In the past, leading up to now, we've actually had a larger flock size up to about 1,000 pairs, but that was when we had quite a large range license. We still have the range license, but it was much more suitable than it is now. There's a lot of environmental changes that have occurred, primarily when it comes to just tree growth. A lot of clear-cut logging in the past created a lot of forage opportunities, and in recent times there's just been less to log in the area. I guess they logged most of it out in the 90s and we had a huge surplus of forage, and then they planted it and it's crept back into forests slowly. And the other big issue on our mountain range has been predation, primarily with wolves. And it was just too hard to navigate through that, even with guardian dogs and a full-time shepherd, and also just trying to find someone that you could afford to hire that could actually do the job and, you know, wouldn't cave in at the end of the year. So that was just getting harder and harder to find that kind of person. So we made the decision a few years ago to start slowly reducing the flock size over time. And we got into doing hay sales to compensate for the loss of income. And then more recently, as of 2019, we stopped taking the flock to the range altogether, which was a huge, huge decision and undertaking, because we knew that that was going to eat up a lot of our available forage and reduce the amount of hay that we would be able to sell. And so that is really what pushed us into a more intensive rotational grazing plan, at least to work towards. I still say there's a lot more that we need to do, we want to do to get more intensive on that front. But 2019 was really kind of the year that it was like, okay, you know, we need to start started an advanced grazing plan. And that's what we did. We put in about 4 kilometers the first year of permanent high tensile electric fence. We purchased a lot of temporary electric fence product to further subdivide paddocks. And just we look for the most important areas to start subdividing, whether separating prime hayland from more pasture unhayable land. We had a lot of area that was interconnected, and we couldn't graze, you know, the pasture or only or the forested, semi-forested pasture while we were growing out hay crops. So we subdivided a lot of those, just terrain variances and land variances. So that's kind of where we started with separated riparian zones, so we could kind of manage them a little bit differently. And we've just been doing, you know, adding a few kilometers of permanent electric fence every year and a little bit more temporary every year. Yeah, really kind of trying to use the cattle and the sheep in rotation with each other, just the best way to improve our land and expand our land. Because we do have a lot, most of our property that we own is forested. We technically have close to 1,800 acres of property, but we only have about 800 that are actually grazable. And a large portion of that is heavily forested as well. Like, it's grazable, but semi to heavily forested. So there's a lot of room for improvement, and we're kind of constantly working on that front. We're using the cattle to, like right now, I'm kind of in a semi-forested pasture where you're doing some pretty high stock density grazing in order to just really get some animal impact into the soil that is really not really yielding much forage, and break down forage brush and carbon and things like that. So that's, yeah, I guess kind of a snapshot as far as what we're into and the rough general direction where we're going.
That's a great overview. Now, for context, could you share where you're located and just, you know, kind of the climate regime you're dealing with in your location?
Yeah, certainly. So we're located in the Upper North Thompson Valley. So anyone familiar with the city of Kamloops, where about exactly 2 hours drive north of Kamloops on the Yellowhead Highway. So technically classified the Upper North Thompson. As you get above Barrier, it's the Upper North Thompson Valley. I would say that we're in a relatively dry climate most years. Some years, you know, we have more rain than we need, but those years seem to be relatively rare. I would say, well, just went over some numbers a little while ago, and our kind of running average total precipitation is about 20 inches throughout the year, but that includes snowpack, 15 to 20 inches. And some years we get a lot of snowpack, but our actual growing season precipitation, so if you take from April 1st to October 1st, we're looking at more of an average of about 8 inches. Some years definitely more, and some years quite a bit less. I know just about everyone has kind of felt the pinch of dryness this year. To give a kind of a perspective, we have started receiving some rain now, but June, which is usually our wettest month, we usually expect about 4 inches by the end of June. We so far haven't even received an inch. I think we're a little over a half an inch so far, and we're getting towards the end of the month. And that's the most rain we've received in the last few weeks, really, since the snow left. So virtually no rain over March, April. I think we had maybe an inch, just barely an inch over May, and approaching an inch in June now. So, and then the other thing I always like to point out, because sometimes I talk to prairie people, Alberta people, and I'll tell them how much rain we get. Well, they're like, oh, well, that's not too bad. And I have to remind them and say, yeah, we don't have prairie soil, though. Our interior British Columbia soil is very rocky. Our valley used to be a river. And you're pretty hard-pressed to find clay. And the more fencing we do, the more we map out the geological zones. And yeah, lots of sand, lots of gravel and rocks. Yeah, not any, basically any topsoil we have, we've had to build it. Or, you know, maybe there was the odd little patch of aspen for the last 100 years that developed something. So those are kind of our ongoing challenges that we have. But we are blessed with gravity irrigation. We've got three creeks that bring a lot of snow melt through our ranch. So we're able to put in gravity lines to that and irrigate pretty heavily, at least for a window. Like our creeks are starting to dry up now, about a month earlier than usual. Yeah, we're very, very blessed with what we have there, and we don't have to pump from the river and that kind of thing. So we're just finding more and more also just kind of to put a note on the regenerative front, because I know sometimes irrigation can get a bad rap because it definitely gets overused. And I'm finding when you're applying regenerative practices and really focusing on building the carbon content in the soil, so like your soil organic matter, humus, carbon residual on the surface, as well as root mass, it makes your irrigation go a lot further. So like, as I mentioned, we kind of have a somewhat of a brief window where we've got a lot of water available. And then right around, you know, July, summer, kind of when you really want it, is when the creeks start to dry up and you can't irrigate anymore. So we're seeing significant benefit in focusing the carbon, building up carbon in our pastures, so that we can kind of stockpile moisture when we have it. And it's amazing how, you know, even on rocky, gravelly soil, when you've built the root mass, the green mass above the soil, the dead litter layer kind of on the surface, and then your humus, soil organic matter, it's amazing how much water you can hold. And we're just seeing that as more and more critical moving forward.
For sure, especially those conditions you just described make that even more so relevant. You mentioned how you moved away from using the crown tenure. And can you just say or explain, was that mostly to do with your labor challenge of needing to have a herder that would go with that group to work in there, versus now that you have it more on your own pastures where you can manage quite differently?
Yeah, I would say, yeah, it's definitely split as far as reasons. I mean, I find it easier to find someone, to find hired help to help you, you know, move fence. It's easier to find someone to help you do irrigating and moving temporary fence and, you know, doing more short livestock moves than it is to find someone capable of, you know, living with the sheep full time, you know, hunting predators, or at least handling a firearm and doing that. It's a pretty psychologically difficult trade. And I think kind of just, you get a lot of people that hear about it and they come and they apply and you hire them and they sound like they're going to work out well. They think they're going to really like it. It sounds very romantic being up, mm-hmm. you know, in a camp, looking after sheep. But after, you know, a few bad days, it breaks a lot of people. And, you know, in the old days, I think people were just kind of wired a little bit differently. You know, like the last really good shepherd we had was, you know, like 30 years ago. And so it's just been a lot of struggle since. And, you know, that really compounded with the predation losses. Like the last year we were up there, we lost about 90 head, just primarily from wolves. We were literally losing at least an animal per night. And like one morning we found 16 losses using lambs. Pretty difficult. And that was really that predation event that just kind of made us stop and go, we just can't afford one more year of this. Better put the money that we're losing due to predators into our fencing. And I mean, that's not to say there isn't predation challenges down on our domestic land, but it's mitigated much better. And interestingly enough, the more intensive we get with our controlled rotational grazing, the less predation we get, because we're keeping our animals in a tighter area. The guard dogs are far more effective. And, you know, you can just imagine if you have 600, 1,000, over 1,000 animals with the lambs in a 200 acre pasture with multiple benches and forests and land dynamics. And you might have 5 or 6 guardian dogs, but they tend to all sleep under the same tree during the middle of the day, the heat of the day. And if your sheep are spread out from one corner to the next, it's pretty easy for a bear or a coyote or a wolf to just come in, make a kill, eat what they want, and the dogs don't even know.
And that's what has happened. But the more we subdivide our pastures, the less that happens. And some of those pastures that we still haven't subdivided, like we do have one, like a 200 acre pasture that we do kind of have to range graze for a time and until we do get it subdivided. But what we're doing right now is we just pen everybody up in a net fence corral. So it's about, a little over an acre and about an acre in size, I guess, maybe a little bit more. And we'll just move it every few days as it gets heavily manured. We move it to a clean spot. So we're not technically rotationally grazing in those areas, but we are rotationally bedding. So we're able to not just keep them safe at night, basically minimize losses, but we're also able to strategically place the manure exactly where we want. And so it's quite a bit of work, but it's a lot of benefit. And again, you don't have to have someone there day and night. And the most vulnerable time for predation is at night. So now we just don't have losses at night as long as they're locked up in that pen.
Now, you mentioned you started investing a lot more into your fencing and developed your grazing management plan. How did you approach that in terms of where you decided to do permanent fencing versus where you keep the more portable, flexible fencing?
Yeah, it's a really good question because I know we spent a lot of time thinking about that. And that's not to say that we didn't make some errors there, I think. And I think it's really easy. It's probably actually easier to put permanent fencing where you find out later on you didn't need it, especially the more portable fencing you acquire and the better and more efficient you get at dispensing it. You start realizing like, oh, hey, it's plenty easy to cut that section off with a temporary reel than it is with, just to put an expensive high tensile fence there. So, but the approach we kind of took first, I think I may have kind of alluded to it earlier. We tried to kind of just identify the land types first. So for example, where you have a hayable field, something you can actually work equipment on, and maybe it's more irrigated than other areas and it's just more productive. So we would try to trace that land type out. And then if, adjacent, there was a semi-forested pasture that, the animals didn't really go in very often. When you gave them the whole area, they would hang out in the most productive area all the time because that's where the sweetest feed was. And they didn't go into the bush or the drier areas or the weedier areas. And we do have a lot of areas that are, that are drier and unirrigated that grow mostly, spotted knapweed, sulfur cinquefoil, hawksbeard, that kind of stuff. So we weren't even getting the animal impact there. And sheep and cattle, as long as they're fenced in a tight enough, great enough density, they'll eat just about any weed. Cows right now, they're nipping off the tops of knapweed and sulfur cinquefoil because they're in tight paddocks. So by identifying those land types and separating them, still keeping them relatively large, you can... I found that just really helped out to figure out exactly, okay, there's a permanent fence. It's going to go here. It's going to go there. And also like riparian areas. So like a creek pasture, we'd fence that off separately. Maybe in some cases you'd permanently fence off a river if you weren't worried about flooding or ice wrecking it. So yeah, I guess like forests, creeks, benches, if you have a break where there's an abrupt elevation change, put a fence there. The other thing I found, if I was fencing, say, for example, fencing a kind of a forested area off, I had a tendency just to get the fence in quick. I would put the fence out in the field further just to get away from the bush. I did find, though, that resulted in higher vegetation load on the fence, robbing your voltage. If one took the time, and I'm doing this more and more now, I actually take the time to brush a trail in the forest a little ways. It's quite a bit more initial time and labor and expense, but it's kind of a one-time shot. And then you run that fence kind of in the bush. Now you're not going to have a vegetation problem, or at least a very low vegetation problem. And the other flip side is you kind of have a shade buffer. So if you have large fields that you are cutting up into strips, now you have an area where the animals can go into the shade and get some relief when it's hot. And if you don't want to over fertilize the shaded areas and you're having, you're grazing in the early spring or the fall, and they just don't need the shade, then I'll actually temporarily fence off those shaded areas just to focus the manure out where we want it. Yeah. And then as far as size, permanent paddock size, you know, a standard reel, polybraid reel is holds about 1300 feet. So ideally you want your large permanent paddocks to, at least in one direction, on one side, you want to be no further than about 1,000 feet apart from fence to fence. That way you can at least cut, you know, from one end to the other. And then the other thing too is taking into consideration any current water systems. So like we use our irrigation lines for stock watering quite a bit. So we quite often would run a, we'll run a permanent fence kind of, if it works out, doesn't always, but if it works out, along a current water line, irrigation line, and now you got flexible water points. So just those are kind of the things that I look at when I'm deciding where to put permanent pastures and permanent fences.
I was just going to ask you, after fencing, water is usually the next consideration and how you might do that. But you kind of answered that. And then do you run just an access line from that into troughs that you have in the pastures?
Yeah, everywhere is a little bit different. You know, if we have an area where, you know, say we do have a water line, but there's a lot of pasture and a lot of distance from that water line, and you can't build Rome in a day. So you can't go out and put 10,000 feet of water line wherever you want it. Every year you put out a little bit as you can afford, along with the fence, build some fence, put out some water line. But yeah, in the meantime, you can, you know, get your fence established, develop your grazing cell pattern. And as long as you have enough temporary fencing on hand, yeah, we often will leave a lane, a movable lane that gets longer as the animals get further away from the water source. Or in some situations, it's probably not an ideal from a grazing management perspective when the forage is growing, you know, very quickly. So you got lots of moisture, maybe you're kind of right in the middle of the spring flush. So everything's growing almost right after it's bitten off. But if you're in the summer slump where things are slow and they're not growing right away until they get some rain, I think it's totally fine just to not have a back fence with those animals. You know, you're just moving a front fence and they can walk the length of the field. They're going to focus all their grazing on the new strip of pasture. It's just, you got to be careful. Obviously, you don't want them taking that second bite. If they take a bite and in about 3 or 4 days, that grass sends up another shoot, you don't want them to bite off that new shoot until it's recovered, is kind of the idea. So, you know, it's all about flexibility. So if you're in a drought and it's not growing back right away, I wouldn't worry about it. I wouldn't worry about a back fence. You know, same goes with, I mean, I'm kind of struggling right now with having the time to graze as intensely as I'd like to. And it is harder with sheep, just to mention too, because although I do a lot of grazing with a single strand of polybraid, you do have to use like 4 times more posts with sheep than cows. Depending on the forage quality, sometimes you do have to use 2 strands, or at least for your front fence, you need 2 strands. So that's a lot more fencing and a lot more dispensing. So, you know, when you're just really, really busy and there's just too much going on, I try to at least go, okay, I'm going to give them a bigger pasture, but they got to be moved after about 4 days. And because that's about how quickly the grass is regrowing. You don't want them to stay there and graze it back. So yeah, the more intensely you're grazing, and obviously in relation to your water, back to your initial question, how you're moving the water, whether you got tons of water line out and you're putting out a brand new tub in every pasture, and they got a front and a back fence and they're completely contained, I would say that's ideal, but that's not always realistic with what you can do. We can't kill ourselves with labor trying to do the right thing. Sometimes we just have to do the best thing we can at the time.
What sort of pumping systems do you employ? Is it, do you work with any solar, or is it all kind of from a central system with your irrigation setup?
So yeah, we're currently running everything off gravity. Like I said, that's kind of our advantages. We do have a lot of other disadvantages, but our biggest advantages is gravity. And that even though our creeks will start to fizzle out at different times of the year, we'll pretty much always have just enough water for stock watering, maybe not enough for irrigating. We got to turn all the sprinklers off, but as long as we're careful with how we manage it, there's pretty much always enough water in the pipe to have a pressurized tank. We use the advantages we have. Yeah, so far we haven't had to do any kind of pumping. We have some plans. We have one pasture that does dry right up. It's creek water, so we are looking at putting in kind of a well and a solar setup pump. I think it's the way to go if you're pumping for livestock. Solar is definitely the way to go.
Now, some people struggle with the concept of using electrical fencing, even for cows, but you're doing it for sheep. So maybe you can share a bit about how easy or how not easy it is and how that works out for you.
Yeah, well, definitely if you are successful at using electric fence, cows, it's as hard as falling off a log. It is so easy, electric fencing cows. And that's actually one of the main reasons why I even got into cows in the last few years, just because I wanted something that was really easy to manage with electric fence. And I do definitely manage the cows a lot tighter on a tighter management scheme than I do with the sheep, just primarily because it's just so much easier. You know, like I said, one strand post space, like 50 plus feet apart, sometimes 100 feet apart. And once they're trained, I mean, and training's key. Like the biggest thing, doesn't matter what species you're training. Sheep are probably the most difficult other than goats. But any species you're training, you have to have a really hot fence. And the biggest mistake I see a lot of people do, and I talk to a lot of people about this because one of my side enterprises is I do sell electric fence product and do a bit of consulting. So a lot of people ask me these questions. And I find most people try to go with an energizer that's far, far too small for what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. It might be adequate at some times of the year, or it might be adequate if your animals are already trained. But if you want really good results, I just find you have to buy the biggest energizer you can afford. You have to take into consideration how much vegetation load you're having, how much grass is going to grow up on the fence and steal your voltage. How many wires do you need? Like with sheep, you need more wires and lower wires. The species depends. The species will kind of help dictate the size of the energizer you need. So much larger for sheep than with cattle, for example. I think it's really beneficial for people to have some kind of tester that they can test voltage on the fence. You know, for sheep, kind of the rule of thumb is you want 8,000 volts on the fence when you're training them. Once they're trained, you can get away with a lot less. With cattle, I mean, they're fine with about 5,000 or 6,000 when you're training them. But either way, the better you train them, the easier you'll be able to get by with less voltage on the fence. If, you know, like this time of year, we got more grass growing on the fences, so there's a little less voltage than there is in the spring or in the late fall or in the middle of summer. So, I mean, there are lots of times when I'll turn the fence off and I completely forget to turn it on the next day. And I was grazing the cows at high stock density and they're just fine. They never figured out the fence was off. They just figured it was hot and they better not try it. So in mature sheep, I find are actually pretty good. I do a lot of intensive grazing with my ram flocks. We got about 30 head of rams and they're real wimps when it comes to pain, just kind of like men, I guess. And so they're pretty easy to contain. And again, lots of times the fence will be off and they won't even know it. The hardest is young lambs. They're just always, you know, I think they have a really poor memory, you know, calves to an extent too, but I don't know. Lambs just seem to have a really bad memory. Maybe it's just because I have too many of them, but you know, they're always grazing up into the fence. And if you have one wire, they can't see it that well. So it's not that they're constantly trying to challenge it. They just don't see it. And they haven't been shocked enough to, you know, really develop that sense for it like the sheep. So you know, that's why I'm fine with young lambs. You kind of got to start with several strands and then work your way down as they mature. So, but yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, the biggest thing is get a really big energizer and make sure your grounding system is excellent. I mean, the general recommendation is 1 6-foot ground rod for every 3 joules of power. Energizers are usually rated in joule rating. And so a lot of people will try to get by with one ground rod and a big charger. Might work when it's wet outside, but when it's dry outside, it doesn't work. I like to go overkill with grounding because it's not that expensive. Go overkill with the energizer. To put it into perspective, the energizer I'm using technically says on the box it's good for 250 or 330 miles is what mine says. And I'm energizing about 12 to 15 kilometers. So, and there are times when with the amount of vegetation load I have and the amount of power I want on the fence, that isn't even quite enough sometimes. So yeah, that's kind of the where, if you spend big on the energizer and the grounding system, you can save a lot of time and headache. And I mean, where you save money with electric fences is the fact that you can use high tensile wire, which is literally half the price of barbed wire. And you can use half as many wires with electric high tensile than with barb. So, I mean, for most of my cross fences, I'm running 2 strands, and that's typically just fine for sheep. The primary post that I'm using for electric fencing is the brand name is the Timeless T-Post. That's a product I do sell, and I sell it because I got into it to use for myself. And it's a PVC UV resistant T-post that's very lightweight but very sturdy, very easy to put in. You know, as long as they're installed correctly and you keep energy on your fence, they last a lifetime. Like, they don't rot, they don't break as long as animals aren't running through them. But even so, they're very resilient. So, you know, they run about the same cost roughly as a treated wood post, but last far longer and are just infinitely less expensive to install. I'm always, that's what really drew me into electric fence initially, was just something that was really easy and really fast to install once I'd figured out how to do it, and something that would last as long as possible, because I don't like, you know, redoing work that I've already done once in the same lifetime. So yeah, so that's kind of what I've found that's worked for me. You know, I'm a big fan of trying to keep fences economical, but at the same time, you know, there's that balance of, you know, you want it adequate, but you want to save money. Economy versus where economy meets functionality is kind of where I'm always trying to find that intersection.
Now, you touched a little bit on the different densities you like to run for your sheep versus your cattle. Can you kind of share, for example, in a scenario where the grass is growing very, very quickly, how fast you might like to move and how dense you might like to have your animals?
Yeah, so I'm always playing around with different things. I try to do something different every year. I don't know if I'll ever figure out the holy grail of perfection, but I think the important thing is if we just keep trying things and, you know, try to imitate what we felt like worked the previous year. You know, one thing I did with one of our higher production fields, and it's a hay field, but we just try to take one hay crop off our hay field. So we're grazing it a couple of times before, and we get our hay crop, and then we graze it in the fall and winter again. And so what I did, we grazed it early with the sheep kind of just before the spring flush came at pretty low density. Like, we gave them a large, basically the whole permanent paddock for a few days, and then moved them out before they'd creamed everything. And that's key, you know, as you're just before you get to the spring flush, you have that very tender, very washy grass, that green up, we like to call it. And one of the mistakes I'm often making, ironically, is because I don't want to make the mistake of grazing it too early, I quite often make the mistake of not grazing soon enough. So it's that hurry up and wait game where we're feeding our animals, you know, stored forage or stockpile, and we want to put them out onto the green up pasture, but no, it's not quite ready yet. We got to let it build some root reserves, you know, and then finally you make a decision to send them out, And you, the thing is too, you never know how, what the conditions are going to be, what rain, what warmth you're going to get. And so sometimes it just feels like you get these cold springs. So you hold them back, you hold them back. And then all of a sudden you look at the forecast and it's like, oh yeah, tomorrow it's summertime. And like this year.
Yeah.
So it's definitely touch and go and difficult. I'm a big believer with that early green up. We have to be so careful we don't overgraze, because I've seen pastures where I've grazed too hard too early, and then you can see the impact throughout the year, and they can get tons of rain or irrigation and good growing conditions after, but they're still set back because they've been hit too hard. So I like to kind of get the animals out on a low density and move them quickly early on, just kind of get what you need and then move on. Maybe even supplement with a little bit of hay, even though you have enough feed to sustain them in that early period. I'm finding more and more, if you can supplement with some hay, not only does that stretch the feed out further and you're not forcing them to graze more, but it's also better for their rumens and their stomachs. And so their poops get a little bit firmer that way. So that's one trick I use. And then as we get into the spring flush and things start dashing to bolt, you know, the grass is just trying to race you to get that seed head developed. I'll start getting more intensive with my paddocks. And one thing I did with this higher, one of our most productive pastures, is on the second pass with the cows, I gave them, I mean, from the cow perspective, it was actually relatively low density, but I was moving them every single day. So I was giving them very narrow strips. That's just kind of how it worked out with the field, because small herd of animals in a big field, it's hard to chop it up into little squares. The nice thing about rectangles is it causes, at least the cows anyway, they can tend to go ping pong, go back and forth. And I find that they tend to take a really nice tip grazing pass. There's going to be some trails and trample, but that's, I'm not too concerned about that at that point in time. I just want to get over it and get them to kind of just open up the forage canopy, get some new growth coming in as soon as possible, because that's kind of what we're racing against. We're trying to set back the forage that's maturing and give the understory a chance to express itself. So you tend to get, you tend to increase your legume growth after that grazing. So you're kind of grazing back the grass, which usually initially grows a lot faster than legumes, and you open up the forage canopy. You're at least opening things up so that higher quality forage can grow in. You can get that higher quality forage sooner. And then after that pass, we'll come back usually with the sheep, because they're a larger bunch with higher levels of impact. And then we can really graze that field harder and do a lot of trampling, put a lot of litter on the ground so that we're in good condition as we go into, you know, drought season for moisture retention. And in some situations, like if we have a lot of residual head out and we're not able to, you know, concentrate the animals enough to get a good even trample and graze, we'll even come in and just mow it and leave it. And then let the next crop come up. And that quite often will be a hay crop after that, a later hay crop.
I was going to ask you too, like when folks are working on getting a grazing plan going, you know, the record keeping often seems to be a bit of a stumbling block. You know, do you have some sort of a technique that you're using? Like, you know, every night you take 10 minutes to jot down your notes. Are you more like the spreadsheet guy who likes to plan it all out on your computer? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I'm the kind of guy, I wish I was more of the spreadsheet guy. And I guess I'm always kind of trying to work at doing, being a little more organized that way. I'm a big believer in it, at the very least, writing down where you grazed, when, you know, even if it's as simple as taking pictures. If you're kind of just too busy to get around to actually writing down in a notebook, taking pictures on your phone, and then you got a date and you know where the animals were at that time, I just find it so valuable to look back and, you know, for kind of figuring out rest periods and also just tracking year to year, like where were we with this group at this time of year? And I think it's kind of probably the easiest record keeping to do. Take a picture and try to, jot down some notes every night. And then the other thing, it can be as simple as every couple of nights, I'll just grab the calendar, paper calendar, and go down with a pen. And this group is going to be in this pasture this day, this day, this day, this day, this day. And it's surprisingly how easy it is to plot out, and very accurately, especially the more you do it, you can just kind of figure out in your head, I know this pasture is going to hold them for this long. This pasture, we're going to cut up into this many pieces, and that's that many days. You're not always 100%. And I always try to leave a bit of a buffer when I'm, kind of forecasting the next month's grazing plan, so to speak. And so I always try to, I'll write down what I think how many days will be in an area, and then I'll add another couple of days just in case I'm out. That way I'm budgeting for some fudge factor. And it's incredible how beneficial that can be. And if you were spot on with your penciling and that's exactly, the amount of time you're anticipating and you didn't need those extra days you added, you got them for somewhere else. And it really does feel kind of like, you're budgeting out your forage. It's kind of like building a business financial budget and, managing money. I mean, that's really, I think, how we have to think of our forage as grazers. It really does translate to money. Every day of grazing is cash in one way or another, because that's a day of gain for your animals, or whether you're finishing animals, growing animals, or just boarding animals, doing custom grazing. Every day translates to money, and it's not all about stretching out as many days as we can. That's not what we're trying to get to. In emergency situations and drought situations, yes. But we want to be always thinking about giving ourselves the amount of time so that we can leave the pastures in as good a condition as we can. Leave some residual so there's still some solar panel to collect sunlight and to retain moisture. Make sure there's enough trample. I know that's a kind of a dirty word. Sometimes we feel like, and that's the way I was brought up, because it was all about utilization. And we don't want to miss any utilization. So we want to leave the animals out there until we see everything cut right down, ground right down to the ground. And in previous times, that makes the rancher feel good, because it's like, oh, I harvested 100% of what was out there. Well, I've come to realize that's kind of like, you get your paycheck from your job, say at the end of the month, if you get paid once a month. We all know it's a bad idea to go and spend that whole paycheck all at once. Or even if you spent all that paycheck throughout the month, and then your next paycheck comes and you had nothing before, you want to put some of that aside. You want to put it into an investment, put it into a savings account, and slowly build your wealth. And that's just how I see it with forage and our soils. When, whatever nature gives you on the pasture, that's your paycheck. Don't harvest 100% of it. Roll as much of it back into the soil as you can afford. If, we think of the soil as our bank, and you weren't able to cash in on that forage that stayed in the pasture that got trampled, but it's just, think of it as it's getting rolled in as an investment, and it's going to pay dividends when I need to hold more water through a drought, or feed more soil life and build more soil to grow more grass. It's a long-term investment. So that's where I think the forward planning is really crucial. Like I say, even if it's as simple as just getting out a calendar and writing down your days, and figuring out how much can I afford to, roll into the soil this day? How much do I need to harvest that day? And like I said, depending on different times of the year, your priorities might change a little bit. But ultimately, the more detail we get, getting into like a really rigorous spreadsheet, I think is definitely important. But at the same time, we don't want to overcomplicate it to the point where it's like, oh, it's just too much for me to do. And you keep putting it off every night because it seems like a really complex procedure. I'm a big fan of trying to keep things simple and then grow the complexity as needed. So that's just kind of how I do it and figure that out.
Yeah, definitely some notes on the calendar are way better than no notes at all because it's too much of a hurdle. For somebody who's maybe just working on their grazing plan, and often the question comes up, how do you know when to move on, right? So you could look at the current paddock. Some people suggest you should look at the next paddock and also see if that's ready to go into. Do you have some thoughts on that, how a person can gauge that? And I guess it depends on everybody's goals, what you're after.
If you have a pasture that you're trying to improve, let's say it's very low organic matter and very weedy and not a lot of forage growing, and your real ambition is to grow that and improve that, then the focus is going to probably be a little less on the livestock and a little bit more on the pasture itself. So that's going to kind of dictate whether, you know, how tight your stock density is. Tighter stock density to get higher levels of animal impact. Whereas if you already have a pretty good pasture, you've already been doing the right thing, it's in good condition, and it's growing you lots of forage, your priorities are definitely going to change because now you want to get maximum yield out of that soil that you've created or been blessed with. And so in some situations where the soil is already in poor condition, I think it's a good idea to let the forage go to seed and get as mature as possible. Try to get as much residual seed developed and as much above ground carbon developed. Quality is going to be a lot poorer. Your animals aren't going to do as well. Or certainly, like if you're trying to finish animals, they're not going to do as well. But if you're just running, you know, cull cows or rams, bulls, something like that, you're not too worried about animal performance. And so you're going to maybe let those pastures go to seed and get as mature as possible and then graze them very tight. Whereas if you're, okay, I got finishing animals, I'm doing grass finished beef, or I'm finishing for a client doing custom grazing on a high quality pasture, I think you're going to want to probably move those animals, put the emphasis on the animals a little bit more than the pasture. So you're going to want to probably move quicker, try to get over the pasture before it heads out, leave lots of residual. Don't worry about grazing it right down and just focusing on grazing the leaves and the tips of the leaves and the flowers and things like that. And I mean, when I switch, like if I have a little group of steers that I'm finishing for slaughter and the last month or two, if I suddenly switch that management and start moving them, sometimes it's funny because you'll move them so frequently or give them larger areas and move them frequently. And they won't even want to go because they're like, well, I haven't even touched every corner of the pasture I'm in. But you keep moving along, they keep taking the cream, and you'd almost think they were on grain. It's incredible how fast that they finish. So I think you kind of mentioned it right when you asked me the question. Like, it really depends on what your goal is for your livestock and your land, depending on, you know, when you move. And like I said, I mean, circumstantial too. Like if you're in a drought, you know, you've gotten rid of all the animals you can afford up to that point, and you're just trying to maximize utilization. Hopefully you were giving back to the soil in the good times, in the rainy years. You can afford to take a little bit, graze that stockpile right down, take a little bit more from the ground just to buy yourself time until you get rain again. So you definitely have to take, you know, a very holistic view, I think, of the whole plan, not just the one season or the one year you're in, but all the years, as many years as you can kind of look at it once. And I think just the big thing to remember is just flexibility, and what are your goals?
I'm wondering if you have some thoughts on, as you started implementing your more intensive grazing management plan, you kind of mentioned 2019 was when you switched things up a bit. How quickly did you notice your soils improving?
Oh, well, in some areas, very quick. It's interesting. Like I'd say in general, your better soil will, like if it's already pretty good, maybe it's worn out, maybe it's been abused, but you know, it's naturally better soil. That is where you're going to see the biggest improvement if you start grazing correctly. Having said that, I found there are some areas, pastures where I thought all the soil was just junk because nothing was growing there but weeds. And once I started incorporating livestock in higher stock densities, all of a sudden, like not the whole pasture, but certain areas like veins, like there was some veins of good soil that I didn't even really know about. You know, maybe it was a low-lying area that had some deeper clay or silt, or it just wasn't rock. It wasn't performing until there was animal impact. And I mean, the awesome thing too about, well, both sheep and cows, I mean, they spread legume seeds like crazy. I mean, if they eat mature red clover seed heads, for example, they pass out all those seeds in their manure, and they're almost like mechanical seeders. And so areas where I've never seen legumes grow, just all of a sudden, because there was a diamond in the rough that I had no idea about, it just exploded. So I think that's the biggest thing. And like that was happening within like a year in some situations. And so I think the biggest surprising factor was you find how much land you had that it was actually good. It just needed to be woken up by, you know, the appropriate amount of stock density. And I mean, and I still have fields today where I thought I would see a better response. You know, you are seeing a response, but it's like, well, you just have to be patient and let it improve in the time that it needs. Cause I'm just finding that, I think especially in our area, we have so many different geological layers and patterns. There's just so many different soil types. You know, one field will perform extremely different than the next field across the road. It's you never know until you start moving the animals and concentrating them where they haven't been concentrated before.
Very neat. Almost like opening little gifts and you're not quite sure what's going to come out of it.
Yeah, totally. Like I say, places that you never thought would have really produced that quickly.
Maybe in closing, if somebody's interested in reaching out to you, like you mentioned, you offer some support services with electrical fencing. And if somebody's interested in working with you, how would they best find you?
You can either shoot me an email at joseph@avaleyranch.com. And then my cell is always available as well. I think all that information is on our website. Cell phone 250-674-8695. Yeah, I'd love to speak with anyone that's working on a grazing plan or interested in fencing or water or whatever. Even if you're not into buying anything, that's fine. I love networking with other people and finding out what people are doing.
If you enjoyed this chat, check out the other episodes in this brief 5-part grazing series. Also visit bcforagecouncil.ca. and peaceforage.bc.ca for more great information on regionally relevant forage and pasture management tips. Funding for this project has in part been provided by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada through the Agriculture Climate Solutions Living Labs program.